My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I hail from Toronto. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973. I have a group. I'm active in that home group. I have a sponsor. I use that sponsor, and I sponsor other people, and that's about all the statistics you're going to get for now. Okay? I'm glad to be here. And no, I'm delighted to be here. Maybe delighted isn't even the right word. There's a special something about being here. I don't know what it is. I won't bother to try to define it. But part of it is the people who are here, Dick and Barbara, of course, and Clancy, of course, and all the rest of you, and I understand it's Bob and Linda's 51st wedding anniversary today. I was married once. I made a year and a half, so I'm impressed by you two, and I'm impressed by you two. My task is to talk about steps 10 and 11, and that intimidates me in one sense, and in another sense, it is my journey. It is the journey of a soul that brought me to the place where I am dedicated to steps 10 and 11. To tell you where I'm at today and what those steps mean to me, I'll tell you a little bit about where I come from. Some of you know my story probably better than I do almost, but I'll tell you briefly the kind of person that I was and the kind of experiences that I had and the way I looked at the world and the way I saw myself, of course. And of course, I was born to a family of 10. We were Roman Catholic, of course, and I was the baby of that family. I do not have a horror story. My family loved me. They treated me well. But by the time I was 3, I was crying because I had a sister. They called her retarded. She had injured at birth. She couldn't learn as fast as the other kids. They kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. She knew she was different. She cried. She'd crawl into bed with me. I was 3 years old, and I cried with her. And she'd say, "Why am I like this? Why was I ever born?" And I'd say, why am I like this? Why was I ever born?" And that pretty much covers the way I have felt about life for a lot of the time, regardless of how well things went sometimes in the third dimension. So my family loved me. So those 8 brothers and sisters who were all adults, I thought it was a simple case. Go to them, tell them what they need to do, and Dora will be happy, and Dora stops crying, I stop crying, the world's good. Didn't happen that way. I thought they didn't fix her because they couldn't. I understand because they wouldn't. I understand now. They didn't fix it because they couldn't. I went to God. We were Roman Catholic. We went to church every Sunday. And I don't know if the priest said it, but somewhere I heard it. God is love and God is power. And I used to sit on the woodpile and look at the sky and look at the stars and look at the aurora borealis and the beautiful sunsets in Saskatchewan. And I knew that God was good and God was power, and I gave him his instructions and he didn't listen either. And as far as I was concerned, God became a useless twit. I can't tell you how much that affected the way I saw things. And then at 5, the miraculous happened. I took a drink. My father made home brew, and one night when he was serving his friends, little Mildred poured the drinks, and I poured some into myself, and it was game over. I got the unnatural reaction, and that's what I chased for the next 35 years. I hated being sober. I love being drunk. Why anybody would not want to be drunk is beyond me. That part in the big book, I identify with everything except that part where people say the various things they did to try to control their drinking. Why would you try to control something that's so amazing? And so I tell you, it took me down because, see, I don't think alcohol was my problem. I love when Bill says it's a spiritual malady. That's what's wrong with me. I can't get along with the world. I don't get along with God, and I don't get along with myself. And so when I find something that makes me feel better, I chase it. And that's what I did with the alcohol, and I'm not going to tell you. I drank whatever I could. Sometimes it was perfume. You smell good when you do that. Sometimes I drank vanilla when I couldn't get other stuff. I always tried to find a way to modify what was going on inside. And so, what was my life like? I'm smart. I don't fit, but I'm smart. I finished high school when I was 14. I couldn't get into university. Fooled around a bit, and I'm drinking alcoholically. And at 17, I decided to go to a convent. Not a smart decision when you're an active alcoholic. However, I found a convent that eventually took me. Why would I go to a convent? I didn't want to go, but I somehow had it in my head that maybe I could maneuver this God to make me happy, to make the world okay. And so with that, I entered. They took me without smelling me, and I was drunk in there for 15 years. And I could give you a whole long story on that. I won't. At the end of that time, and nobody ever said anything to me. It's amazing what you get away with. It's amazing what you get away with when you're smart and you work hard. I did. And I guess I was a fairly good nun, except with whatever had to happen so I could stay drunk. At the end of that time, Mother Superior called me and she said, "I don't think you're happy here." And that was the understatement. I remember thinking, why does she say here? I'm not happy anywhere. I don't think anybody's happy. That was my attitude to the world. So we wrote Rome. I got my dispensation. And January the 10th, 1966, I stood on the convent's steps to say bid that life adieu, waiting for the car that was going to take me. I had my secular name back. I was again Mildred Frank. I had been dispensed from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and I had my secular clothes on. You know, I remember the day, and every time I go back to the convent, it overwhelms me because I remember the day that I took my vows. I was dressed all in white, including white shoes, and the rule was, as before you did your vows, you prostrated yourself on the altar, and you promised God what you were going to do with your life. And I remember it was a sunny day, and the chapel had beautiful stained glass windows, and the organ was booming, "Magnificat anima mea Dominum." My soul does magnify the Lord. And that's the way I felt that morning. My soul was going to magnify the Lord. And it didn't turn out that way. And yet, in another way, I believe that every step of my journey has been the journey to God through the grace of God. And so I left the convent. I found where I needed to be, the bars. I found the men found me, and I very shortly was in a life of degradation. I often think of that period, it was like being on a landslide, you go to the top of it and go whoosh, right to the bottom. 3 months, I'm in jail, and the chief of police came down because I was making such a racket. And I still remember him looking at me, and he had the dossier of the thing, remember, I'm out of the convent 3 months. He had the dossier of the things that had brought me to that jail. And I remember him looking at me with disgust. And he said, "What's wrong with you? Look at this." He said, "You were a nun 3 months ago. And look at this. Don't ever show up in my jail again." And I couldn't give him an answer. So that path was to continue. The I signed myself into 999 Queen Street, which was the Ontario Insane Asylum, because I didn't know what to do. And by that time, the hospitalizations had started. I've been locked up 32 times in psych wards. I've had 38 electroshock treatments, so I join you, Clancy. I was tied to the bed many times, and it wasn't for fun and frolic, believe me. I was put in straitjackets, I was put in cold water baths, and all of this kind of thing happened. I couldn't stop. Anyway, my brother found me at night, and he took me back to Saskatoon, and there I was to meet my destiny. I met my destiny in the form of two psychiatrists. One was the man I married. I thought sex and therapy at the same time would be a good deal. It turned out to be quite different. Instead, I met Dr. Hoffer. And Dr. Hoffer knew Bill Wilson, and I won't get into that story. He intervened. He was not my physician, but he intervened on my behalf, and he said, she doesn't have all those illnesses. He said she's alcoholic and should go to AA. My brother had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my father had phoned me to tell me that my brother was transformed. He said, there's this organization in Saskatchewan. He said, it's just new. He said, I don't know what it is, but it's good. And he said, your brother has been transformed, and he works very good with my father. And so when Dr. Hoffer said I should go to AA, I was excited. I went to AA. 3 weeks, I sat and I waited. Who's going to transform me? With all my education, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know who was going to do it, and after 3 weeks, I couldn't stand the way I felt without a drink. But by God, I'm not leaving AA. My dad said, good things happen here. So I stayed, stoned. I won't get into that, except to say, you can sit, park your hiney on a chair, and if you do what I did, it's going to not wind up good. And so at the end of 5.5 years, but those 5.5 years, I think back to 15 years in the convent. What did I get there? I got a great learning about the spiritual life. I didn't know how to practice it, but I learned a lot because I studied a lot. What did I get out of those 5.5 years? Chuck Chamberlain, who used to sit with me, and he'd say, you have one problem. And I'd say, no, Chuck, I have multiple problems. No, no. He said, you think you're separate from God, and when you get that right, you'll be okay. I met people like Mac Cheater. I met people like Cease Corgill. I met people like Wes Parrish. And I think about how good they were to me. They tried to talk sense, but I couldn't hear the music of AA. And I think God was in it every step of the way. And so at the end of that 5.5 years, I drank again. I was married at this time. My husband was also an alcoholic. There had been big violence in our home. We separated, and I wound up on a park bench. I've had DTs and convulsions and the whole business, and I couldn't stop, and I really didn't want to stop. I wanted life to be different. I wanted to be fixed, but I didn't want to stop drinking. May the 18th, 1973, the police took me off a park bench. You know, when I stand here today, I think, is it not something? I think back to being the dirty tramp on a park bench selling my body so I could get a few drinks and living like that, and I've been transformed. I don't have to live like that, and I don't live like that anymore. And so the morning of May the 20th, 1973, the nurse took me to the washroom, and I saw myself, and I said to her, I've become a woman of the streets, haven't I? You know, when you come from a family like I come from, a family of integrity, and you've spent 15 years in a convent, and all of that, I can tell you, when you have to say, I've become a woman of the streets, put, you know, just think what that involves. And she said, yes, you have. What are you going to do about it? One of the most crucial questions I've ever been asked. She took me to breakfast and then took me back to my room, and I asked myself, what am I going to do about this? And I did an assessment. I looked at all the things that I had done. Church, lots of church. Music, you know, I had gotten degrees in that. I'd gone to university. I had had success. I had won prizes. I had won awards. I had had men. I had had vows. I had had God knows what. I had tried it all. I couldn't think of a thing. I was homeless. I was penniless. I was friendless. And my mother said, you can't come home the way you are behaving. If you will be sober, you can come home, and otherwise, you can't come home. Good on her. And so I made a decision. I can't do life. Our book says we have to concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholic. I had done that years ago. But what I had never conceded was this: I don't know how to live. And that morning, I conceded, I don't know how to live. I haven't got a clue. And so the only thing I knew, get out of here. I had a niece that had committed suicide. She was a severe schizophrenic. And she left a letter, and in the letter she said, Mother, don't worry about me. She said, if there's a God of mercy, he'll understand. And if there's no God of mercy, it doesn't matter anyway. And so I decided, I'll go with it. I'll go with that. And I asked the nurse to get my coat. I mean, if you're going to kill yourself, you should be warm, I guess. So she went to get my coat. I never talk without telling this because it is the most truthful thing I know. The one thing I absolutely, you could say, I'll shoot you if you don't take this back, I'd say shoot me. Because it happened in a heartbeat. The compulsion and the obsession were taken. 1 minute I stood there, the kind of person I've described to you, and the next minute I stood there and I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm clean inside. I don't have to drink anymore. I don't have to take drugs anymore. And that is indeed what it was. That to me is the grace of God. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what had happened. But that's exactly what I felt. And in 45 years, I have never had the compulsion. Thought, it's done. It has. I'm still alcoholic. Don't get me wrong. But I've never toyed with that idea that maybe I should take a drink. I thought suicide a number of times. Anyway, I remember saying, you'll have to send me somebody. I don't know how to live sober. And there was a rap on the door, honest to God. And this man stood there and he said, I saw you at breakfast. You're in trouble. Are you? He said, are you alcoholic? And I said, yeah, you want to make something of it? And he said, no. He said, I came to see if I could offer you some help. And he told me, you know, those of you that are new, those of you that are very young, you can find this hard to believe. There were no treatment centers in Toronto. I don't know if there were in the world at that time. This was a hospital Dr. Bell had started. He believed that people who were addicted, some of them needed extra help. And he said, I know about that place. He wasn't an addict. He wasn't an alcoholic. He was just a good person. He said, I'll take you tomorrow if you'll go. And Monday he showed up and he took me. And Dr. Bell took me. And at that time it cost, I think, $2,000 or $3,000. I had not 5 cents. I went through the program. They didn't push God, suited me fine. Didn't push AA, suited me fine. And after 28 days, I was discharged, and I went down to Skid Row because I had no home. They gave me a little money, and I got this room, and I remember opening the door, and I going, and I was to live there for a year. I wish I had time, but I have to tell you, I was poor. There were days I had nothing to eat, and yet that year, in a way, was the most quiet my soul had ever been. I had no hope. I didn't argue with anything. I just breathed. And my psychiatrist at Dawnwood said, you have to get a job, and I went rapping on doors. A day and a half it took, and a man said, I'll let you come to my factory, and you can sweep the floor there. And he gave me a little money every month. It was enough to keep body and soul alive. And that's, you know, I think about that time. I had no radio, I had no television, I had nothing. I was just quiet inside. Maybe my soul needed that for what was coming. And one day I went to see Dr. Maharaj. He was the psychiatrist at Dawnwood. And he had taken an interest in me, and he said, you come see me once a week. And I would walk 8 miles back and forth to go and see him, and he would sit with me. He was a dedicated Hindu. He didn't talk religion. We'd sit together, and I'd leave there, and I'd have hope. And then next week, I'd go back and fill my soul again with whatever happened when I was there. And 6 months went by, and one day I was in the institution, and a man said, you want to come to a meeting? Had many invitations, so I said yes. And I went with him, and I came to an AA meeting. And I don't remember. All that I remember was people were nice. That's what I remember. And at the end of it, I had no pretty clothes. I didn't look good. I had teeth knocked out and all the rest of it. They said to me, keep coming back. And I thought, what do they want me to come back for? And I was broken. I couldn't put two thoughts together. So I kept coming back and got a sponsor and fell in love with AA. And she got drunk. And then the unimaginable happened. Two men stepped forward. They didn't want anything. They were good, dedicated members of AA, and they said to me, you are too sick to stay here if you don't do the steps. And I said maybe the first honest thing I'd ever said. I said, I don't know how. I can't even properly read now. And they held me accountable. They said, you come early and we'll read the book to you. We'll tell you what to do. And I really believe this. Doing the steps is of the heart. It's not of the perfection and how mechanically wonderful you do it. And I'm not saying people shouldn't do that, but that wasn't what we did. They told me simply what to do. I did it, and I got to stay. And one day a man walked into the group, and I knew that he was my sponsor. I asked him to sponsor me, and he sponsored me for 41 years. He died 2 years ago, and I still miss him. And, you know, I owe Clancy a lot. I owe Jim a lot. Jim had the ability. He was strong. He didn't boss me around. He told me and he showed me how to practice the principles. You know, people said, do the steps. I don't do the steps every day, but I try to live by the principles. And he showed me how. I haven't got time to get into that. But then the God shot started to happen. You can't convince me that grace isn't in this room. Tom Ivester took me aside one time when I was about 3 years sober, and he said, I have a message for you. He said, I have come to believe that there's a power of good. He said, I had plans for my life. He said, those plans did not materialize, but he said, that power of good, and I still remember him doing that, he said, it has taken me places that I could never have dreamed. And I tell you today, I believe today there is a power of good, and it has not given me what I thought I should have, but it has taken me places I couldn't have imagined. And it has taken me to a place in my soul that I couldn't have imagined. See, the God shot started to happen. See, I've learned there's a third dimension and a fourth dimension. And I remember Sandy Beach one time saying to me, he said, I don't think you know this. He said you came in a two-in-one package. You came in a body and a world, but he said you also came with a soul and a spirit. And I had been paying attention to this part. And the God shot started happening. At 1 year sober, I got a teaching job. 7 years sober, I hadn't saved any money. My sponsor made me pay off my debts. When I demurred, he said, they want not your money, they want their own back, with interest. So, 7 years sober, another God shot. I had saved no money, and I bought my first house. And I didn't have to sleep with anybody either to do it. That was the big thing. And I was to buy many houses, and I became a really busy little CEO of my own life. And I bought houses, and I sold houses, and I rented them, and I became really rich. This person that was on the park bench, I built a big house, and I had my red convertible, and I had my driveway. Everything going great. Lots of men in my life, the guy that couldn't stay sober, I've tried to fix him. One day I came home, he was lying on my bed, saying, Millie, get me some beer. I said, no. I said, you pray. He said, I don't want to pray. I grabbed his ears, and I pounded his head in the bed, and I said, you pray, you son of a bitch. And then I, too, went to Al-Anon. Anyway, getting on with this. Where was my prayer life? It was non-existent. You know, I thought when I was asked to do this, I thought, what am I going to say? The truth was, I didn't pray. I was a good member of AA. You can park your hiney on the chair and not have to leave. If you're like me, I wasn't taking drugs, and I was going to meetings. I had a sponsor. I was sponsoring. If you looked at me, you'd have said, there's a good member of AA. But I was not okay inside. And I got away with that for a while. I enjoyed all the activity that was going on in my life. And then I started to feel not okay. Not okay at all. And I'd go to the old timers and they'd say, Mildred, you got to go to more meetings. Well, I was going to all the meetings that I could. Something was not right inside. And now the God started happening. I was coming home one day from a conference. And I would, you know, I'm ashamed to say it, but I was speaking at that time. I could talk the God talk. I had lots to say, but I was not living the God talk. And I was coming home, and I was 18 years sober. I still remember it. And before my eyes, because I'd been thinking, I'm going home, and there's nobody there. My house is empty. I'm all alone, etc. And I saw that paragraph from the big book, the day will come when faced by a self-imposed crisis, you will have to make a decision. Either God is everything or God is nothing. What is your choice to be? And that's what tore me wide open. What's my choice? And I thought, well, I don't think it's nothing. I don't know what it is, but I'll go for everything. Now, when you say something like that, now you got to step up to the plate. I didn't know how, I didn't know what that meant. And then I was sober 20 years. But I had started, and my sponsor took me through the steps again. And those two men were right. There's magic in them, their steps. We did the steps again, and I changed. And I began to see it was time to retire from my job, which I did. I hadn't properly prepared, and I left a relationship of 15 years, and I became suicidal. And my sponsor, God bless him, he knew exactly what he said to me, you're going to follow a routine. You're going to get up in the morning at the time you always got up. And we did a series of things, and that really saved my bacon in a way, because It kept me even. And then this happened. The phone rang one day, and it was Father O'Brien. See, I believe Tom was right. There is a power of good, and the book is right. It's everywhere. I believe it's in this room. And I don't think grace is something you earn, because that doesn't make sense. I think grace is available. I just have to open my soul to it, and whatever it is that needs to happen. And I don't think I decide how my soul is going to grow. It's up to me to suit up and show up. And grace flows because God knows who I am, how I am, where I am, and knows exactly what is required. Because I'd never met this Father O'Brien, and he called me and he said, I'm calling because, he said, people have been calling me about you. And see, that's another thing. I'm sitting there feeling depressed, and the answer is being prepared. And he calls me and says, I want you to come and give a retreat. And I said, Father, I can't do that. I've been excommunicated many times. And he said, I don't care. He said, I want you to come. They tell me you know something about the spiritual life. And he said, you're a great educator, so I want you to come. And I went. And it was the start of a whole new life. I gave a retreat to these 70 women. And the morning that, see, the things I'm telling you, I couldn't have orchestrated. I couldn't have. I didn't know I needed them. I didn't really like women a lot. And I really lived behind walls. And that morning, the last sermon, the last talk that I gave, I started to bawl. I didn't cry pretty like they do in the movies. I bawled. And out of me came these strange words that I had never heard myself say before. I am the loneliest person in the world. I don't have one friend. I have many acquaintances, but I don't have one friend. And I'm telling you, it was as if the crust and the walls around me dropped, and I stood there just exposed. I can't describe it any other way. And that for me was the beginning. How do you live life when you've operated from behind your walls? You have not let people see what you really are, who you really are, when you haven't allowed yourself to feel. Not me. And there, it's all gone. And that's when I started to grow. That's when things started to change. And I knew something else. I knew that I had to start meditating. I don't know that a voice told me that, but I knew that I had to change. I knew I had to get into the book. And something else had happened just about that time. I became aware, once those walls went down, I became aware of something else. I became aware of those voices that I had heard since childhood. I'm not talking about schizophrenic, psychotic voices, just that inner talk. Nobody cares about you. No, you're not important. Nobody loves you. All that kind of stuff psychologists say. We have 40,000 of that going through our heads. That negative stuff was eating my lunch. And one day, a man named Ted from my group came over to see me. And Ted is one of the special ones. Ted is one of those who reads the book and puts it into practice. So he came to see me, and he started to quote this. He said, well, you know, you have stuff buried since childhood, etc. And me, in my great wisdom, I said, that's too psychological. We can't do that. He said, get your 12 and 12. And he read to me. we may find that though the harm done others has not been great, the emotional harm we have done ourselves has. And here it comes. Very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. Now, I know for some people, they don't have to go and do this. I did. This opened my eyes. He says at the time of these occurrences, they may actually have given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. Bill Wilson wrote that, and I'm grateful he put it there, because that was a big step in my life. And he goes on later on to say, we can go far beyond those things which were superficially wrong with us and see those flaws which were basic, flaws which sometimes were responsible for the whole tenor of our lives. That's me. And it was amazing to me how books came into my path, how people came into my path. A speaker, I heard him. He talked about the bondage of self. He talked about how, you know, and this isn't about let's hate mommy and daddy. That's not what this is about. This is about spiritual growth. As long as I'm listening to those old lies, I can't grow. I had to find something, and the teachers came my way who showed me what to do about those old ideas. It's not true nobody loves me. God loves me. It's not true I'm not important. But I've got to take that and make some changes. And I had to make some big changes inside if I was going to do what was coming. You see, here on page 77, I came armed because this fits me. It's after step 7 where he says, at this moment we are trying to put our lives in order. I was doing that. I had put a lot in order. But the next sentence, he says, this is not an end in itself. Huh? I thought if I could just get my life together and get it in order, he goes on to say, our real purpose, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And there were two words in there most of my life I had missed. To fit ourselves. It does not say our real purpose is to be of maximum service. It's, of course, that is there, but it says to fit myself. Do you know, in the days when I was in the convent, you know, if I was half drunk, I was really very kind. I was a really good person. And people used to say, that's Sister Eugenia. She's really something. She's really a good person. There was not a good bone in my body. I was an ass kisser. See, I always felt so bad about myself that it became my mission to get you to be nice to me. And I had to size you up. What do you want? I'll give that to you. If you want money, if you want me to do things, if you want my body, if you want whatever, I'll give that to you, and then you'll be pleased with me, and you'll like me, and everything's fine. Here it says, and it hit me, and my sponsor said, you have to fit yourselves to be of yourself to be of maximum service. You have a lot of work to do to change. See, of course, that's why our tradition says this is a program of attraction. A lot of my life, you wouldn't have wanted what I had. I was bitter and angry. If you got me at the wrong time, you wouldn't have wanted any part of me. So, how do you do that? Well, step 10 says, and I had ignored this, why would I pray? See, Prayer kind of implies a relationship, doesn't it? I like the definition of Emerson. He said, prayer is the contemplation of the facts of life from the highest point of view. Whoa! That says it all. I feel unhappy. I feel I don't fit. I used to contemplate that from what was wrong with you and what was wrong with me. He says, contemplate it from the highest point of view. By this time, I had also read page 164. You know what I love about the big book? What I love about the spiritual way of life? It all makes sense. And if it's the truth, it hangs together. On page 164, he says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and then great things will come to pass for you and countless others. And there's Emerson. I started to read Emmett Fox. And what does Emmett Fox say? Life is consciousness. What you've got going on inside is what you're going to see out there. You want to know what's going on in here? Take a look. And if you don't like what's out there, see, I spent 60 years of my life analyzing you. I remember when I was in the psych ward, because I'm articulate sometimes, they used to have me on the stage with the psychiatrist for teaching the doctors what life is all about. I would be the patient that they used, and I would analyze, and we analyzed what was wrong with everybody else. We never talked about what was wrong with Mildred. Poor Mildred is the victim, you know, because of what had happened. And here again, he says, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I looked at step 10, and I'd look at that piece where he says, we set right any new mistakes as we go along, and that's about all that I saw. And then as this process was going on, I'm now sober 20, 21, 22, and then I started a meditation practice. And, you know, I tried transcendental meditation. I couldn't sit still. And then somebody taught me a meditation practice using a mantra. And that has been my practice now for 24 years. 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes at night, and I understand why I'm doing it. I did my homework. Bill says in here, the object of meditation is always the same, to improve our conscious contact with God, with his grace, his wisdom, and his love. And that's exactly. I don't always want to sit and meditate. Sometimes I think, I'm a busy girl, I got things to do, places to go, people to see. And it's the most important thing I do. And it's the faithfulness to that that really sticks. And that allows a quality of life now that I would never have dreamed that I have. See, the walls coming down, what happens? Like, how does that change? I remember one time being with a bunch of women, and something had happened. I don't remember what it was, but some of them started to cry. I didn't. I said, why are you crying? And they said, because we feel sad. And I went home and I thought, there's something wrong with me. I don't feel sad. I think sad. I can do it in my head. I lived with this intelligence. I thought I could fix my life. I can analyze it. I can do it that way. And it didn't work that way. And that surely is one of the things I learned from Clancy and people like that. You've got to get into action. And then something else happened. Like, I can trace this as clearly as I can trace a road map. I began to look at page 55. And on page 55, it says, deep within, Every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I was sober at that time about 26 years, and I have to tell you, I didn't like you so much. Not because I didn't like you, I didn't have the capacity to like you. I could like you up here. And something happened when I started to look at that. And my spiritual advisor was so good. Deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That has another one of the ideas that has absolutely changed my life. See, when the Master was here, he said, you have to love everybody. He never ever said, you can study the philosophers, you can study any spiritual teaching you like. None of them ever say you have to like everybody. I always think if you like everybody, you're on something. But to love, that's another thing. And in our world, I think we associate love with sex and a lot of emotion. I think the best definition that I know is to wish good for people. And I think in the context that it's written in the big book, deep within is that life force. I don't have to agree with you if you're a murderer. I don't even have to like you. I don't like everybody. But it's my job to love everybody, to recognize. I think to myself, and I'll tell you something, the world looks so much nicer to me today because I know something now. I was a really nasty person for a lot of my life. I was full of self and full of everything that goes with that. Was I a bad person? No. What I was spiritually asleep. And if you look at those glorious steps we have, the promise of those steps, it's not a big house, and it's not fame and fortune. It's that we will wake up spiritually. And so that has changed my life. What it has changed to is this. This used to be the way a lot of my emotional world, a lot of my inner world was full of judgment, criticism, hatred, and blame. Those were my four horsemen. And you know what? If I remember that God is within you, I don't have to approve of you. I don't even have to like you. I just have to remember who you are. And a lot of that has gone. And with that, my heart has opened up. I feel I'm being very honest, very open today. My goodness, I shouldn't tell all these secrets. Better not be misbehaving again, eh, Mari? The thing is, through this work, this prayer and meditation as it's laid out, I see the world different. You know, I don't like a lot of what's going on, but I understand people are asleep. And me criticizing, if I have to correct something, of course you have to do that. I'm not talking about being Miss Pollyanna and pouring pink paint on everything. To do what you have to do where it is yours to do it. But I don't have that hatred and judgment inside anymore. I like what Carl Jung said. Three things that he said that really have touched me. One was, he talked about the secret gnawing, G-N-A-W-I-N-G, at the roots of our being. How many times have I felt that secret gnawing? I thought it was for a man, or for stuff, or more stuff, or better stuff, or maybe if I could get you to change, then I'd be okay. I believe it's that secret gnawing that Bill talks about, the need to be consciously aware of God. You know, I love the letter that he sent. I think he wrote it in 1956 to a woman who was grieving. And in that letter, he said, "I used to think that the purpose of life was happiness." He said, "I don't believe that anymore. The purpose of life is the pursuit of God. And through that, we get the peace that the world cannot give, a peace that is beyond understanding." Now, my spiritual advisor, I'm almost done. My spiritual advisor told me to make a plan. And I think that was really wise, because some of the language, like in step 10, where he says, we have a daily reprieve, and, you know, we need to keep working. Like, how do you do that? My spiritual advisor said, make a plan so that you can do other things, but that every day you have an idea of how it's going to go. Isn't that right, Jackie? And so my plan, I get up and I do my exercise. And then I do my spiritual reading, and then I do my meditation. I like what Bishop Spong says about that. He said he used to regard prayer as the holy activity. He said now he regards prayer as the preparation for the holy activity of going out and living life and giving love and life and goodness in the world where we are. I think that really makes sense to me. Before I unlock my door, I do this every day. I put the key on the floor, and then I take a minute to remember, God, you live in me, you are my life, and you are the life deep within every person I'm going to meet, and I make it my business to try and treat everybody and see them that way. That's my second thing. And then I go out to do my so-called holy activity. I believe today my purpose is not to give retreats. My purpose is not anything else but what Bill Wilson said here, to grow in conscious contact with God. Of course that involves being of service. Exactly that. But it's from a different energy. I like what the HeartMath solution. It's a company. You know what? Do you Americans know how fortunate you are? So much good has come. So often, you know, I read something. Who wrote it? An American. You know, who put forward this idea? The HeartMath solution. They've taken a picture of the energy around us, and they say we carry an energy around us of about 8 feet, and that your energy reads my energy. What if my energy is all about me, 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 me? You're not going to be very attracted to that energy, I think. But what if that energy is the acknowledgement that there is the drummer, and God lives in the drummer, and that's a beautiful thing. We read each other's energy. How are we going to make a difference? I love this stuff. You know, St. Francis' prayer, what does he say? Let me be an instrument. What good is a trumpet if you don't have a skilled player? And I think, God, let me be the instrument. You do the playing today, and it will be a good day. I have a God book. I keep a record. I watch God. He's a show-off. How the hell I bought a house with no money. That's showing off. I keep a record because I forget. I forget what happened 3 days ago. So I put the date, and this is what happened. And one day when I'm down, I pull out my God book and I think, whoa, you're at it, God, let's go. Family, I just will close with that. I shut out my family. And by the time I woke up, my mom and dad were gone. And that's another whole story. And my brothers and sisters, I have one sister left She's 91, and I'm going to be 86 next week. Aren't I a good-looking 86? And full of good health and good energy and full of a soul that is so at peace. And but I've got 35 nieces and nephews. We weren't Catholic for nothing. And one day when I was home, I thought, like, I have written letters to wherever my brothers and sisters and their husbands and wives are to tell them I see it different. I shut them out. I realize now what a fantastic family I come from and what I learned from them. And the fact that, well, I am the product of who they are, and I'm just grateful for that. And so we had a dinner when I went home to Humboldt, Saskatchewan. You remember when everybody seems to know where Humboldt is these days? That's where the big accident took place. And my nephews and nieces were all there. And I took that occasion to tell them, because I'm much younger than my brothers and sisters. I'm kind of the age, I'm a little older, but some of my nieces and nephews are, they were shielded from me. My brothers and sisters saw that. They never knew what a bad actor I was. And you know, that Catholic family of mine, they never wanted anything for me but to be okay. They're so proud of me. They love me so, and I love them so. And I told them about how wonderful their mothers and fathers were, the goodness that they offered me. You know, I left the church, I left the convent, I married outside the church. Like, I did everything that a good Catholic family would not be hoping to see happen. And you know, I never got one word of criticism from them. They've just loved me and cared for me. That dinner and my telling them about their parents, my big nephews, they're all about 6'4". They sat there and cried. They said, "We didn't see that side of our parents." And that was the amend I was allowed to give. How in it's not possible for me to find the words to say thank you to God, to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You started this so beautifully, Denny, in saying thank you to Bill Wilson. And I repeat that because my grandfather did not get the benefit. My grandfather died of alcoholism in Tutopolis, Illinois, in sometime in the late 1890s. I had an uncle who died who was shot. I had an uncle who died in a swimming accident. And my brother and I, he was sober 49 years when he died. He walked the way before me. We got to be here because this program flowed. I believe God's grace flows to us if we just open our hearts. And I thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with you. God bless.